Hey, good morning, everybody, and welcome to The Conversation. I'm your host this week, John Stevenson, subbing in for John Orr. Our phone number here, 503-325-0010, and our topic today is 1969, the 50-year anniversary of so many things. And we're hoping that we can get some of you to call in and share a personal story related to a big event in 1969 or just 1969 in general. If you were an eyewitness to that year or to any of those events, we'd love to get your story. There's three guests with me in the studio today. Lisa Smith, who's a longtime KMUN person, currently the secretary of the board of directors. She's a programmer, and she's been a station manager at KMUN. Buzz Bissinger is here, noted writer, if you remember Friday Night Lights, commentator, knows a lot about sports, and general raconteur. And Graham Nystrom is here, the station manager, who was not a witness to 1969, unless he was here in a different form that he won't admit to. Life form. But he might even have something to weigh in on of what people from his generation, the children of boomers, think about when they hear 1969. So let me rattle through some of the events of 1969 and see if this stimulates your memory. Some of it's nostalgia. Some of these things are just huge events that have a long-lasting impact. Knowing this history is the best way to explain the present and probably to predict the future. Gas was 35 cents. The Dow Jones was 800. Nixon became president in January. The Beatles gave their last live performance. Abbey Road came out. There was a moon landing on July 20th. And what I'd like to say about the moon landing is, if you've got a story around that, maybe hang on to it, because we're going to do a special show in next month focused only on the moon landing. So maybe hold that thought. Woodstock, the most famous of the large music festivals that happened that year, was in August. Draft lottery came into effect. 550,000 people, Americans, were in Vietnam, and this was in the context of troop withdrawals. Peace with honor as a propaganda slogan was invented, Vietnamization. Public broadcasting was established, the Stonewall Riot, which has been in the news recently. Chappaquiddick, which manages to live on and on, happened in 1969. The Northern Ireland Troubles, euphemistically called the Troubles, began in earnest. PLO was founded, the Boeing 747 made its debut, the first ATM, the first microprocessor, and the New York Mets beat the Baltimore Orioles, and the New York Jets beat the Baltimore Colts. New York Jets were probably a better team than the New York Mets. New York Mets in 1968 came in ninth out of 10 with nearly 100 losses and followed under the tutelage of Gil Hodges with 100 victories in 1969. I missed all of this, but I know a lot of you were eyewitnesses. So consider that this is sort of a time travel show. Personal stories related to these events or personal stories just of being in 1969 and having a memory of the atmosphere and things like that, that's what we'd like to hear about. In that, Lisa is distinguished for having been an eyewitness not only to 1969, but as a participant and attendee of the Woodstock Festival. I know nobody else on earth personally that has done this, and I'd love to hear about it.
Well, I want everybody to know that I was 15, so that means I'm 65 this year. I'm not 85, okay? I was 15 years old, and my friend Eric Aman and my other friend Eric Vega announced that they were going to go to this festival that was happening upstate New York. I lived in New York at the time. I lived in suburban New York City. And Stig Vega, Eric's older brother was going to drive because we were all 15. Eric and Erica and I were all 15. And so I told my mother and father, I didn't lie to them. I said, I'm spending the weekend with Erica. And I was. And then they figured it out when they saw those photographs, you know, all the news that came out of Woodstock when the flyover, when it was just declared a disaster area. But at any rate, it was a really wild time. And I'm wondering, anybody out there listening, maybe we met somewhere. Maybe we shared some marijuana or LSD. Although, remember the brown acid, it was bad. It was bad.
Maybe but, they had sex with you.
No, I don't think so.
No?
No, I would remember.
No, you wouldn't.
No, I probably would. Hey,
I'm Buzz, by the way. Good morning.
Yeah, he's sassing me.
And he's taking this personal story.
But it was fabulous. You know, it started with Richie Havens. Well, the thing is, Stig Vega he was about 5 years older than us. So he was 20-ish, right? 25, maybe. Maybe 10 years older. Anyway, he figured out that we needed to have a portisan. So he made one. He got a director's chair. He cut out a hole in the chair, in the seat. He took a shovel. We shoveled. We had like the first composting toilet ever, I think. And we were, it was very, very much in demand. And we had tents. And Richie Havens led off. And I was there for that. And I was there for Jimi Hendrix at the end. It was really remarkable.
I was wondering, you know, technologically, how was the sound quality?
Like, it was magnificent. Even through the rain. Although, you know, most people did not play through the rain because it got really windy and really rainy. But I only vaguely remember because it was 50 years ago, believe it or not, 50 years ago. But come on, everybody, 503-325-0010, we want to hear from you.
So as a 15-year-old, were you cynical about it at all? Like, did it seem like a big money grab?
Oh, no, because nobody had to pay. I mean, we didn't have tickets. Nobody paid. We just went through they'd tried to put up some fencing, but then they said forget it because it was just wild. But we got there early enough that we actually got a campsite and so on. So it was really terrific. And it was really so much fun. It was peace and love and wavy gravy and the hog farmers, and it was terrific.
And you could see the stage from where you were?
Oh, yeah. I when Jimi Hendrix played, I was just right about at his feet. It was
because
amazing.
No one was there when Jimi played, right? It was Monday morning.
That's right.
And it was empty.
That's right. It was not empty. I wouldn't call it that. But it was probably had like maybe 150,000, maybe 50,000 people still were there.
I mean, I didn't go to Woodstock. I was a very hermetically sealed up kid.
Where were you living at the time?
Well, I was living in New York City. I was living in Manhattan.
Weren't you in prep school then?
I was in prep school. But looking back, I mean, I think Woodstock was the greatest single spontaneous combustion event of my lifetime. No one really expected that amount of people to come. I vividly remember the New York Times that Sunday with this huge front page picture of traffic jams and hundreds of thousands of people. And to me, it was really sort of the height of the 60s. And it's interesting it happened in 69 because the world today is totally different. And I don't really know what lessons, frankly, we've carried forward since then. But I will say this, that when Lisa was courting me, we're husband and wife, she mentioned two things the first night. One, she was at Woodstock, and two, that she rode a motorcycle, so she had me right then and there.
Right.
What happened to the motorcycle, Lisa?
I still have it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm lending it to Graham, I think, though, because it's a kickstart, and I had some problems with my legs because I'm an old woman now, and I'm 65.
You whine too much.
Well, that's it. That's true. Anyway, John, tell us about where you were, because this, you know, the thing about Woodstock, and also there was the huge March on Washington in 1969 also, a lot of anti-war demonstrations, and you were actually in, where were you? You were in...
I was in Da Nang.
Da Nang.
About an hour outside of Da Nang.
How is it going? How did you feel about people like me who were having sex and drugs and rock and roll and protesting the war?
I was only 18. And one of the most remarkable things was, so away I went as
a... Were you drafted?
Drafted or was it?
Well, both, actually. At the time... Because I wasn't a scholar, so I was going to get drafted. And they had this thing called the Navy. They had a way you could enlist, and it was essentially a draft dodge, not unlike the Coast Guard, or for a lot of guys that thought the National Guard was safe, that's where they went. And the Navy Reserve was a draft dodge, not exclusively, but...
Not if you ended up in Da Nang, it wasn't.
No, the whole thing backfired. And I never got on a ship. I never got the cool bell bottoms. I spent the whole time on the ground outside of Da Nang. But just talking about these events, so January of 1969 away, I went to training, and I arrived there in May. So I essentially missed all of 1969 from a culture, pop culture standpoint. And when I came back in 1970, everybody I knew and everything just seemed so radically different. You know, little things like the length of a sideburn or the music that was being played or marijuana. All of this didn't exist before I left, and it was everywhere when I came back. So that was a gobsmackable wake-up call for me when I finally returned. So when you ask about what was my attitude or what was our attitude over there about people that were trying to end the war, it was mixed. And on one hand, you had sort of the remnants of the patriotic fervor of stopping global communism and stopping the domino effect. And there were still a lot of people over there, GIs, that were singing that song. And they had real problems with the anti-war protesters, that they were, you know, supporting the enemy or supporting the communists. On the other hand, you had another large group that saw the protesters as people that were trying to save our lives, whereas Nixon was trying to get us killed. And I had a particular event right before I came home, maybe a week or 10 days before then. It was around Kent State. And something had happened, and there was a bunch of us gathered together drinking beer, and Jane Fonda had done something, and
she went to Vietnam.
I think she went to Hanoi, maybe. That was the time, or she had spoken out, or anyway, she was in the news, and the same group said, Jane Fonda, you know, they ought to do something about her, or something violent, and take her out. And I made the comment, she's that same sort of comment, that she's trying to save our lives, and what are we so mad about? And when I walked into the office the next day, the commanding guy said, there's Stevenson. He doesn't care if they burn the flag, which was not what I said at all, but still it was all conflated into that. And that was a dangerous thing over there. If you became a problem, you were in real trouble, and they could make whatever time you had left.
They could shoot you.
Very miserable, and good thing was I only had a short time left, so by the time they would have exacted their punishment, I was back home.
Jane Fonda didn't go to Hanoi until it's early 70s, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but it was something related to her that caused the argument.
Well, the point of the 60s, you know, it was a time of great protest, a great revolt in certain corners. And I think the idea that you could protest, that you could galvanize politically, that you could get hundreds of thousands of people together was both exciting and made, at that time, a tremendous difference. And I would like to point out, we talked today, obviously Trump is horrific and the division in the country. But, you know, there was tremendous division in the country during the Vietnam era. This is not new. We had McCarthyism. You know, we had the Civil War. So we have to, this has always been a country in which there's been a lot of debate, a lot of polarization. And, you know, Nixon was, I would argue, a far more polarizing fixture than Trump because of the hideousness of that war that actually started with John F. Kennedy, who really got us in there and left it, and then Johnson, and then Nixon. But the lasting lessons of the 60s, we were talking about that. I don't really see many. I don't see that type of revolt. Certainly didn't see that type of revolt with the Iraqi war. I think kids today are very, very different. Attitude towards music is totally different. Music was seminal to our existence. An album would come out. You know,
That's
new Beatle album, the White Album, you would run, you would get it, you would listen to it, you would decipher it, you would decode it. Now
all
it's all
lyrics.
This streaming stuff.
No, it's not. Well,
what?
Yeah. I think you're right. Never mind.
No, and I really remember that if you got a hold of a record. And records, everybody I knew was broke.
Right. It's,
one person would buy the record and everybody would race to hear it. If it was a double album, it was particularly expensive. Like Woodstock, I think, was a triple album.
Oh, God. Well, there was a couple of things that you forgot about mentioning that happened in 1969. John and Yoko got married, and they held a week-long bed-in for peace. Remember that? And Dwight Eisenhower died, and the first artificial heart. But, you know, the horrible thing was Charles Manson murdering five people, the cult of led by Manson. And that was really horrific. And there's just there's a movie out now. It's called
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's coming out. It has Quentin Tarantino. It's coming out.
That's about that, basically.
Yeah, like I said, I missed so much of 1969. And the information that we did get, we would get a newspaper called Stars and Stripes. And I don't know if it came out once a week or once every 2 weeks. And that's where we got our news. And I recall reading about the Sharon Tate murders, and but even then it was probably after the fact and didn't have a lot of impact on us. Going back to what Buzz said about
the Great Divide,
I was one thing that was going on in the 60s, and so I sort of focused on 1969, is how in a negative way our parents' generation were so astonished, and I'm thinking about this in the context of D-Day being 75 years this year, and how all of the accolades that the greatest generation receives and gets deservedly, it must have just been preposterous to them that their children were not doing what they did at the behest of the government. They went and they believed FDR and the things that they were told about why they needed to go get the Germans. And I know my own dad.
Oh, and the Japanese.
Yeah, and it just, I can kind of understand why this polarization of generations happened. Especially in the context of what those guys did in World War II, to all of a sudden have their children say, no, we're not going to go do what you did.
Well, it was different, though. And they didn't all support it. My Aunt Helen, who was my father's wife, and who is a sister, rather, and who married my uncle, who was a pilot with my father during World War II, she wore peace sign earrings. Like, she looks like a Carol Newman lookalike. She wore peace sign earrings everywhere she went. For a long time, because she was in such protest to the war. A lot of people understood that it was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, they did, and it grew. And I think 1969 might have been a pivot point where the majority of the country tipped towards anti-war.
Exactly.
I can't say for sure on that. I know that by the 1972 election, it was lopsided.
Well, now a guy who says that he didn't go into the service because of bone spurs. Is elected president and has all sorts of support. So,
there's a lot of precedent of president. You know, that's not fair. See, that's ridiculous. There are a lot of presidents who, recent presidents who have not served in the military for one
right.
reason or another.
Bill Clinton
That's the least of his problems. I actually think the biggest divide that happened and occurred because of Vietnam, this is when the haves versus the have-nots started in this country, and it's only accelerated and gotten worse. If you had money, there was no way you were going to serve in Vietnam. You were going to get a college deferment. You were going to know somebody. This is where basically I would call it, and not being dismissive, the underclass, white working class, African Americans, they were the ones who served. I got a draft number. I came from an affluent family in Manhattan. There was no way. There was no way I was going to go to college forever. And this is heightened and heightened and heightened and heightened. And I think this is where it began, of a society of one percenters and a society of the rest of us, which is very different from World War II, where everyone served, no matter what. My family was very liberal, and they were always against the war, but I think you're right. It was horrific to people who had served, who had seen comrades die, who had seen buddies die, who had risked their lives. And by the way, not because of politics. That's all candy. They risked their lives because they felt an obligation to their fellow soldiers. But this was appalling. But this was great and refreshing for America. Things could happen. People could get together, young people to get together, old people, professors, nuns, whatever, and create change. And I think we believe we can't really do that except maybe at the ballot box. And we don't vote. We don't participate. So I don't really know what lessons of the 60s were learned, except our society, certainly economically, is more divided than ever. So peace and love was temporary.
Yeah. As were the lessons of Vietnam. It was culturally pretty much swept under the carpet by the time it was over. Yeah, and I'd right. argue that the lessons of Vietnam, if they had been remembered, would have made something like the Iraq caper a little bit more challenging for the government to sell us on if we had remembered Vietnam. But we didn't. It was by the time Vietnam ended, and you saw those terrible pictures of the Vietnamese people who had supported us begging the evacuating Americans to take them with them. It was disgraceful. It's about as far from peace with honor as you could get.
I think we might have had a caller, do we? 503-325-0010 if you want to chime in. If you want to call in and chime in and tell us where you were in 1969, what your fondest or least fond memories are, give us a call.
But also, what the legacy of it. I mean, let's talk turkey. What really was the legacy besides nostalgia and seeing the Woodstock movie and remembering, you know, Santana was great, The Who was great, Wavy Gravy was weird, you know, Jimi Hendrix sort of was great, but he went on this. What was the lasting legacy? I argue there's very little.
Well, there's some things that were done specifically with regard to Vietnam, like the draft was ended and drinking age was 18, voting age was 18. All of these things were sort of apologies to the 18 to 21-year-olds that had to go fight in Vietnam but couldn't have a drink.
Okay, that's a lasting legacy,
but you could make an intellectual argument that bringing the draft back might equalize the fairness of military service.
We've got three callers, so should we take one?
Let's do that.
Hi, you're on the air. What's your comment or question?
Hey, this is Victoria Stopyellow. When I think about 69, that spring is when I moved from Berkeley, California to Boulder, Colorado. And I lived in Berkeley and finished a degree and then stayed in Berkeley a little bit longer. And my former husband was going to go to grad school at University of Colorado. And so after 6 months of being in two different places, I went out there. To me, the most striking thing about 69 for me personally was making that transition from Berkeley, which is sort of a hothouse, academic, political, cultural. I mean, you can see the world's greatest quartets, you know, in an 800-seat venue, you know, for $2, to going to Boulder, which, relatively speaking, was a backwater at that time. I got into mountains and backpacking and stuff like that. But what really struck me was that when I was living in Berkeley, I was sharing a little townhouse with a woman who had a child in public school. The fall of 68, Berkeley integrated its schools. It was easy because of the geography of the city. You know, all the well-off people were in the hills, and the less well-off people were down the flats, and they just said, oh, we got a school here, a school there. We'll just meld these kids all together. And my friend's son had a birthday party, and he invited over his best friends. And when they showed up, they were all the colors of the rainbow. And the mom had no idea what color the kids were because that never was an issue. It never was discussed. So then I moved to Boulder, and that same spring of 69, people were firebombing school buses in Denver because of court-ordered desegregation of the schools. Mm-hmm. I heard racist comments that I had never heard before out of the mouths of graduate students at the university. I mean, it was kind of stunning, and I think that was a major thing that was going on is we were, as a country, making feeble attempts to try to bring some kind of equity, at least in terms of public education. So that was going on, and the other thing to think about is that my former husband had filed as a conscientious objector when he registered for the draft, And that was never investigated until he was in graduate school. And finally, the government says, okay, we're going to take a look at whether or not you're really a conscientious objector. And they used the FBI to do that. And that meant his mail got searched, his landlord was questioned, the publications he received in the mail were identified, his family were all interviewed, including his brother, who was a pilot in the Air Force. And it happened that, you know, he was a stubborn guy. He'd been arrested in the free speech movement and some other stuff. And he just said, if you draft me, I'm going to go to jail. Now, he was the son of a psychiatrist in Palo Alto, white guy, raised Catholic, so that doesn't count. You can't be a conscientious objector if you're a Catholic. Let's see what else. And after the FBI had interviewed everyone in his family, and they all said the same thing, if you draft this guy, he's going to go to jail. He's not going to go to Canada. And then they just backed off and all of a sudden gave him a 2S status, which he hadn't had for several years. So it's a classic example of, you know, the San Jose Mercury does not want to publish a story about the administrator of the state hospital in San Jose. His son is going to jail in opposition to the war. So I think there were some very cagey responses to who we're going to draft and who we're not. And so that's kind of what I remember about 69. It was a turning point for me personally. But, you know, I come from the sticks in northwestern Oregon. I was not exposed to a lot of sophisticated thinking about race and cultural relations and all that.
Hey, Victoria, we're going to jump to another call here because we're going to run out of time.
Go for it.
Thanks loads for the call.
Thanks, Victoria.
Bye.
Okay, we have to wait for Gabe to patch the next caller in.
I wanted to, on a point that Buzz made about Trump and bone spurs and draft dodging, I think it's salient, and this is anecdotal, but everybody I knew was trying to figure out some way to not go. There were, I don't know if I knew anybody who was particularly gung-ho, so in the context of hypocrisy today, you know, like somebody saying, I love the military, but I was a draft dodger, there's a debate there. But that doesn't, as a vet, that doesn't shake me up too much because including myself, was doing what we could to stay out of that thing.
Well, I'm the proud grandson of a general practitioner who signed a lot of papers for my uncles and their friends.
Bone spurs.
Yeah. I'm not sure what it was, but we've got another caller. You're on the air. What's your comment or question?
Hi. I was wondering the date of the march on the Pentagon, and you're saying it's 1969?
I think it was.
Yeah, because I was on that, and as well as the March on Washington and listening to Martin Luther King earlier, they were both really impressive marches with huge amounts of people.
Yes, it was November 15th. 250,000 Vietnam War protesters gathered in Washington for the largest anti-war rally in U.S. history, according to my internet source.
I mean, the bridges across the Potomac River, the masses of people that were while marching. And then we went all the way to the Pentagon. And one huge difference from then and now is the police were not like SWAT teams as they are now.
Good point.
And I mean, any march like that would have happened nowadays, I think the police response would be huge today.
You're probably right.
Another thing that I also then remember, another big demonstration was before us going into Iraq, being in Portland, a very large demonstration, and there were millions of people around the world demonstrating. Didn't make any difference.
Right, to
no
avail.
We still went into war with Iraq. And then it's, to me, that was people kind of, I feel, just not having the huge demonstrations anymore because the government won't listen is, I think, happening.
Well, they certainly won't listen today. I think you're right about that. There's no question.
And then the other thing that Woodstock was kind of a big beginner of was the momentum of the hippie movement, which I think has made a huge impact on our society. And I've seen a lot of my friends, and we were all hippies, becoming parts of school boards and city councils and government and Jerry Brown and leading California and the where California has gone. I think the hippie movement really made a big difference.
Yeah, it might define some of the elders of the Democratic Party these days. We've got one more call. I don't want to cut you off, but we want to try and get one more in. Thank you so much for calling.
Thanks for calling.
While we're waiting for that next call to get patched in, I'd like to tell you that support for this program comes in part from Blue Scorcher Bakery Cafe, baking up community one loaf at a time, located at 15th and Duane, Astoria. Now with online pizza ordering by going to bluescorcher.coop, open daily, 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. You are on the air on The Conversation. What's your comment or question?
Comment is that 50 years ago, I married a pretty neat guy who had been drafted. He was actually 2 inches too tall and should not have been drafted, but he was, and served his time. There was a comment of folks earlier that I don't know what the benefit or the legacy of Vietnam and that era was. And to me, it's that those folks that knew the value of the vote are still voting, and they are the carriers of most things that happen now. It is the young people that don't find value in democracy, in that vote value. But those of us that were of that age, that vote very important to us. And what we do and the volunteers that you have now are a lot of folks that were back in those days of protest. We're still around.
I think you're right. Thanks for that call. And thanks everybody that called in. And to the guests here in the studio, this has been The Conversation, and it's a far-reaching topic, 1969, and with the station manager in the studio, maybe we can convince him that we can keep this conversation going through the year from time to time and hear more of your stories about what happened to you 50 years ago.